So for the people that just they're seeing this for the first time, can you briefly give us an introduction on what you're building?
Yeah, so we make a muscle oxygen sensor that's for athletes. So it's a wearable sensor, and it measures oxygen levels in the in the tissue of the muscle. So we're measuring in the capillaries and tissue of the muscle, and we can measure in real time while the athlete is working out. So this provides feedback that they can use to train more effectively.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of segues we can go here. I was really excited when I learned about the technology, because all of those years as a weightlifter myself, I was using a heart rate monitor. And from these heart rate monitors, you know, they have these, they're showing you the cardiac output as a percentage, and then you can make assumptions, and a lot of software and hardware companies in this space are demonstrating the cardiac output, and they correlate it with the oxygen of the muscle. But as per our last discussion, what you are describing is that my biceps, for example, my heart rate monitor cannot deduce my biceps and the oxygen that I'm depleting during the exercise. Right. So it was super exciting to learn about that, because this tells me, and it's a very interesting proposition to understand each individual muscle while we are training. How can we understand oxygen in a much, much better way? Now, before we jump into the topic, why don't you brief me about how did you start?
The journey here. Yep. So I'm a mechanical engineer by training, and then I used to design automated machinery for making computer disk drives, and then I got into optical things. We did a lot of optical operations there, and then I got into a medical division within that same company, and I started designing near-infrared spectroscopy devices for medical applications. And then that company, that division of the business failed, and I got laid off. And then after that, I came up with a way to make the technology work in a way that is much smaller and less expensive and more accurate all at the same time. So the previous devices that would do the same kind of measurement would cost $15,000, and they would have a cable, they would have a box that would have to sit on a bench. And they were cumbersome to use, and then they had issues with accuracy. And then when I came out with the idea for Moxie, it was based on a method for getting very precise for knowing how the light travels through the tissue. That's what allowed us to make it less expensive and more accurate. My initial thought was to make it as a medical device. And I met with a professor at the University of Minnesota. He was a cardiologist, and I was talking with him. I said, "Oh, we could use this for cardiac patients. We could adjust their medications and adjust their pacemakers." And he says, "Oh, yeah, that would be great." And he was really excited about the idea. But then he said, "Well, you'll never get to market." He said, "You know, with the FDA," and he's like, "You're just one guy, and it's a non-invasive device, and there's all kinds of issues getting it through the FDA." He says, "Why don't you just make it for athletes?" Then, because the athletes would love this, and then you wouldn't have to, you know, you wouldn't have to go through the FDA process. And then he said, "And then I can, you know, I'm a researcher. I can buy them and use them for cardiac patients, you know, for research in that area." And so that's what we did. Then we further developed the device, and we launched it as a device for athletes. And that was in 2013. We started selling the first devices, and then interestingly, exactly as he predicted, we now have people using it in cardiac failure or heart failure research. They're doing research on patients that have heart failure and helping them exercise in spite of their condition, or exercise in ways that improves their condition. So that research is being developed. It's still not a medical device, but used in research in that space. But then we made the device available for athletes, and we've connected with a lot of really high-end trainers and kind of thought leaders in the space. And we've been developing that aspect of it, you know, how to use the data to train more effectively has been, that's an ongoing development, and that's been going on since 2013.
That's incredible. So the how did the first 10 users learn about the product? Did you try to approach athletes? What was your initial approach for the first ones?
Yeah, that's interesting. It was a little haphazard. We put up a website and we said we have this this new technology. And then I worked with a marketing company and they said, well, you should write some blogs, but don't write about muscle oxygen because nobody's searching for that. Write about things like training with heart rate and training with power meters because people search for that. And so we did. We put up a bunch of blogs about those kinds of topics so that people could find us. And then we ended up finding, or Jürg Feldman found us. Jürg Feldman is a trainer in Canada. And he was actually using some of these $15,000 devices in his lab. And he really liked the technology, but it just wasn't practical for him to do at a large scale because of the cost and because of the limited portability of those devices. So when he found us, he was very excited. And then we worked with Jürg for quite a while. He ran our forum for quite a number of years and shared a lot of the ideas that he had developed on those previous systems. And that really got us going. Then a lot of early adopters followed along on the forum and, interacted with Jürg, and that's where a lot of the methodologies that you see that people are using today actually had their roots in some of these ideas that Jürg Feldman first put forward.
That's incredible. So it's not only the first 10 users that use a product that came from blogging and basically informing the market. It was a long story afterwards with much more users. So was it the first approach you tried in terms of marketing actually worked? Was it the blogs that, was it the first thing that you tried, or you tried something else as well?
No, that was really the first thing. It was actually a startup marketing company and they were kind of hungry for a first client. So we made a deal with them and they did that. And those blogs are actually still up on our site. And we still get new users finding us that way. I'm impressed with how well that has worked and how much time. And we still do, blogging is still one of the methods we use. If you put up high quality content, then people tend to find you through that high quality content. So yeah, that has been a good method for us to find new users. But then far and away, word of mouth, people use it and they tell their friends about it. That's most of our new users come to us that way.
Yeah. That, if it's 2013, I remember myself as well. I was just reading so much information online and content was not what content is today. It was much earlier forms and the available information you could find about weightlifting and nutrition and anything in this space was very different. So it was much more scarce, I would say. But that's very interesting. So it was from the very beginning of the content creation, let's say. That's great. So what about the sensor? So how does the sensor look like today, and how can people use it?
So it's a small wearable sensor. I didn't even bring one with me here, but it's just it's the size of a book of matches, kind of a little bit bigger than that, and you wear it on the working muscle that you're interested in. So it's very muscle dependent. It's not a systemic measurement. It depends on what's going on in that specific muscle. So cyclists commonly wear it on the vastus lateralis, which is one of the muscles of the quads. Runners will be on the vastus lateralis or sometimes the rectus femoris, sometimes even the vastus medialis, depending on the application. We'll measure on the calf. We'll measure on the exterior deltoids. Swimmers will measure on the back. So we'll wear it where, on the muscle of interest. And we'll use multiple sensors too. So typically your first sensor will go on your large, whatever the large working muscle is, whatever the main, and that's why we're on the VL with the cyclist, because that's kind of that main power stroke muscle for turning the crank. And then a lot of times we'll look at left, right balance. So maybe we'll use two sensors that way. And then depending on the application, if you're wanting to do a more systemic assessment, we'll try to look at a non-involved muscle or a muscle that's not as a lower priority muscle is maybe a better way to describe it. And that's why a lot of times on a cyclist, we'll measure on the exterior deltoid. They use it for balance and things, but it's not turning the cranks. It's not a primary driving muscle. And so we call that a low priority muscle. And that can give us information about what's going on more systemically. And then we'll do other measurements where we're looking at like the entire kinetic chain. So we'll measure on the quads and the hamstrings and the calves. And we'll see, you know, when you reach fatigue, does one of those muscles fatigue faster than the others? And is there something we could do with the form to alter that? So yeah, we can measure on all different parts of the body, but it does need to be on that working muscle that you're interested in.
Mm. Okay, so let's just say that I place the sensor on my calf. What am I going to see while I'm training?
Yep, so what we're really seeing is the balance of supply and demand for oxygen in that muscle. So that's kind of the simplest way to think about it. So if the body delivers more oxygen than what the muscle needs, we'll see the SMO2 go up. So SMO2 is the percentage of hemoglobin and myoglobin that's carrying oxygen in the capillaries and tissue of the muscle. And hemoglobin is the molecule in red blood cells that delivers the oxygen to the muscle, and myoglobin is a store of oxygen in the muscle. Myoglobin is what makes red meat red, and humans have quite a bit of myoglobin. So when you first put it on at rest, people always say, what's a good number at rest? But there is no good number at rest. At rest, you're not demanding much oxygen, you're not supplying much, and the numbers are all over the place. So at rest, you know, you might be 40%, you might be 80%, you know, anywhere in between. And then at rest, you could, like if I had one on my arm and I shifted my posture like this, it might change 10 or 20%. Again, because there's very little oxygen supply because I'm not warmed up. I'm just sitting here. And that little bit of change in posture can change the blood flow. And so it's kind of unstable at rest. But then what you see is soon as you put one on and then you start doing work. So you hop on a bike and you start pedaling or you start running. Most typically the SMO2 will go down quickly because you start using oxygen immediately when you start doing work. And that's a little bit of a mind shift. People have this notion that you're anaerobic first and then you become aerobic later, but that isn't quite how it works. And it's quite dramatic. You start doing work and the oxygenation goes down very rapidly. And then you start to warm up. Then your heart rate comes up, your cardiac output comes up, and your blood vessels will start to vasodilate. And the heart rate comes up, you know, your cardiac output comes up in, you know, 3 to 5 minutes, that responds fairly quickly, but the vasodilation can take longer. And so then you'll see if you just start out and do kind of a medium load, it'll dip way down and then your body will start to adapt to the load. And then you'll see this SMO2 creep up. And that's a real common application for the technology is to help people warm up more effectively. How do you get to that vasodilated state where the blood flow to the muscles is really maximized. How do you get to that quickly without using up a bunch of anaerobic sources of energy in the process? And so that's something you get real-time feedback. You can see exactly how your body's responding to the warm-up and know when you're done, know when you're ready.
I see that's very interesting. But I think for the athletes, they would have a different perspective, right? So for a weightlifter versus a cyclist, they would want very, very different things when it comes to oxygen. So what if we take one, speak a bit about cyclists and how the application of the sensor and what should they expect? What should they demand when it comes to oxygen? And then we jump into weightlifting. But if we get into cycling, let's say that I'm having the sensor on my calf. From what you're describing, the way I understand it is that I might have 40% oxygen right now before I start training, and it's going to immediately drop 10 to 20% maybe when I start training a bit. And then once my heart starts pumping up blood, after 5 minutes time, let's say, the oxygen level is going to be higher. And that second value of the oxygen is going to be depleting over time and it's going to be filled much faster. But how does a cyclist need to train knowing that?
Yeah, so a real common application is doing precise intensity control. And so, and this would be true for like any endurance sport, but for cyclists, it's really easy to understand for cyclists. And so what you would do is after you get warmed up, after your body's had said, okay, we're, you know, ready to do work now, the vasodilation has happened and your cardiac response is, your cardiac system is up to speed. Then we look for, what's the highest load? What's the most power that you can produce where you could maintain a stable oxygenation? So you'll see, you start out doing a medium load and you do this for 15 minutes, you get really nicely warmed up and then you stop. And then you'll see now your SMO2 is really high because you're vasodilated, your cardiac system is still going a little bit above what it was at rest, even though you've stopped pedaling. And you'll see your SMO2 gets up to like 80% or even up to 90 in some cases. And then, okay, now you're ready to do some work. So you start working and you're not going to stay at 90. Your body's going to extract oxygen in order to do that work. And if you're kind of doing a medium load, you know, you might drop down to 70 or 60 or 50%, something like that at a medium load, but it'll be steady. So it'll take, like when you start doing this medium load, it might take a minute or two, usually 60 to 90 seconds. And then you'll get a nice steady SMO2. So your body's at, we'll call that homeostasis. Everything's happy. You can produce that load for a really long time because your body's able to supply enough oxygen. You're basically producing that power purely aerobically. You're running all on oxygen. Then you can keep increasing the load, and as you increase the load, you're going to have to extract more. Now, maybe at first you don't. You might be able to increase the load and your body just increases the heart rate a little bit and everything's still fine and your SMO2 didn't go down much. And so you'll be increasing the load and the SMO2 will go down, but it'll still be steady. And then you'll increase the load and maybe it goes down a little bit and still be steady. Then you'll get to a point where you increase the load and the SMO2 will drop more. You'll see a bigger drop. And that's now you're having to extract more oxygen in order to keep producing this load. But we're still really interested in, can you maintain it? So maybe you're down at 40%, but at that load, it just stays 40, 40, 40 all the time. And that's a load you can maintain. Now you increase the load a little bit more, and now maybe it's at 38, but it's 38 and then 37 and then 36 and then 35. And, you know, this might take minutes, but it'll be slowly dropping. And now you say, well, okay, I can't, that's not a load I can maintain. I'm using more oxygen than I'm delivering because I keep going down. And eventually you're going to get to a point then where you have to start using up your anaerobic sources of energy. And then once that's done, then you can't maintain that load anymore. Then they would call that blowing up or all your matches are burnt or whatever. That's what you would see when you go over that. Now, what's nice about this is it's independent of like things like altitude, or if it's a hot day, all of those things will make that transition occur at a lower power. Higher altitude, higher temperature, being fatigued will all reduce your power output, but that transition will still occur the same. If you can maintain the oxygenation, then that's a load you can maintain. But if you go a little harder and your oxygenation is creeping down, then you're not going to be able to maintain that load. And that's where we talk about precise intensity control. So if you're doing, you know, you're doing training day after day and you want to know, well, I really want to stress my system. I want to be right on the edge. I want to do a 30-minute ride where I'm just right on the edge of that load I can sustain. Well, then you can dial that in better than you can do with just your power meter.
So the combination of a power meter with the sensor gives us so much more information, right? So from what you're saying, the more, let's just say I'm using 250 watts as an output on my power meter, and I see that my oxygen levels are going down, then it means that I am in a bit of an aerobic state, right?
So you're not necessarily anaerobic at that point. So the whole time it's going down, you're using oxygen that's being delivered on the hemoglobin, and you're using oxygen that's stored on the myoglobin. And that's a good thing. You know, you're still running mainly on oxygen, but you can't go down forever. You can't go below zero. And so, and actually you can't get all the way to zero either. There's limits to diffusion. And so there's some lower limit, and that varies quite a bit from person to person. But once you reach that lower limit, you can actually still keep going. So you'll go down, 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 and then you'll reach 20%, and you can't get any below 20%, but you're still able to maintain the load for a while. And that's when you really start using up those oxygen independent sources of metabolism. And that's, you know, that's the burning the matches. And that's the thing you kind of only get once in a race. You know, you don't want to burn that up too early, because your body makes you pay that back. You have to rebuild those sources of energy. And you don't want to be doing that in the race, because a rule of thumb I've heard is that it takes twice as much energy to restore those energy sources as what you get out of them. And if you're paying that back in the race, then you're using energy to kind of recharge those oxygen independent sources of metabolism. You know, that's more of a metaphorical way of thinking about it, but that's, that's why you want to avoid, you know, that's why you don't sprint at the beginning of a race. You sprint at the end. You want to use that stuff up at the very end, so that you're not paying it back during the race.
So if we assume that I'm an endurance athlete and I'm doing very long, let's say long cycling events, how would I need to train for every 100 kilometers, for example, to extend my endurance? To increase my endurance.
Yeah, so that's really getting out of my wheelhouse there. You know, that's what we rely on these expert trainers for. But definitely, you know, we can give you the feedback to be more intentional about your training, so you can know that you know, if I'm training in a position, or if I'm training at a load where my oxygenation is creeping down, I know that that's a much more stressful load than if I'm well below that load. And so you can be more intentional about your training. And then when you do things like interval training, you can be much more intentional as well. So you can know when to start and stop your intervals. You can optimize your warm-up. You could just be more intentional about what you're doing with your training, so that you're stressing the system you intend to stress. That allows you to, you know, just be more precise about the training, because you get that feedback, as opposed to just, you know, when you're just using your power meter, you're not getting as much information about how your body is reacting.
Mm-hmm. In the weightlifting space, we haven't seen many sensors out there that can help you improve your performance. And once I've seen what you built, I was so excited about it. Because it's one of the first times that you can really get information about training muscle groups and how you are actually training by using a sensor in the weightlifting room, let's say. So let's speak a bit about that one. What if assuming the athlete is a weightlifter, how can they use the sensor?
Yeah, so it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish. And I just had this discussion with my daughter yesterday. My daughter's a runner. She's a cross country runner, and she's quite accomplished. She was the Minnesota State champion a little over a year ago in cross country. So she's super speedy, but she's in the off season now. She's between cross country and track. So she's lifting weights. And we talked about how to use the sensor to help her do that more effectively. So her goal is not hypertrophy. She's a long distance runner. She doesn't need to be big, bulky muscles. But she needs to be strong, and she needs to have efficient muscles. And just for lots of reasons, it's good for runners to have, you know, to do some strength training. So she's doing that. And we discussed the approach, and we said, well, you really don't want to, you don't want to get into a really desaturated state for a long period of time, because that's the thing that induces hypertrophy. So you want to avoid that. So she wants to stay fairly aerobic, even in her weightlifting. And so what her approach should be is pick loads. So she doesn't need to have the gigantic barbells with huge weights on the ends. She needs lighter loads that she can move quickly. And so, and what we want to do is have her continue to do reps as long as her oxygen keeps going down. So do reps, do reps, do reps. But as soon as she hits the bottom, that's when we've run out of oxygen that we can get from storage. And now we're going to be, now we're going to be getting this energy from other sources. And she wants to stay out of that. That's not, you know, that's the kind of thing that's going to induce the hypertrophy and things like that. So we want to stay away from that. So she'll set up, you know, pick a load so that she can do a fairly large number of reps, do them at fairly high speeds, drop down. And then as soon as she hits the low limit, as soon as she can't go down any further, then stop and recover, and then let her recover all the way. So she'll recover up to, you know, 75, 80. Well, she was getting pretty high. She was getting up like 85, 90%. And so get all the way up and then do it again. And then stop as soon as you hit that low limit.
What's the time that it takes usually?
So this would be like 30 to 60 seconds. So not long. Now, and if you go with lighter loads, you can maybe extend that longer. You know, maybe you'd get to 2 minutes or something. And there are, you know, you can keep lightening the load and make that extend longer and longer. You can make it so you could do it, you know, more steady. But generally, when you say strength training, we're thinking that's not something you can do for an hour. You know, we're thinking this is something that lasts a few minutes at most. Yeah. And if you do heavy loads, you know, it can be 30 seconds, 45 seconds is the duration, but you can see it. You can just see as it goes, you know, as soon as you start lifting, the SMO2 starts going down. So it's super responsive, and which makes it so much nicer than heart rate. You know, heart rate, you're all done lifting and your heart rate is, you know, hasn't even, you know, really begun to move much at all. This is super responsive. So you're seeing
that's
it, right away.
My trouble with the optical sensors as well, because the optical sensors, they are not going to measure the peaks. Even if you use the chest straps, they're going to measure the peaks because of the electrical activity they can deduce. But the optical ones cannot see even that, so it's even worse. But that's incredible because you can measure the oxygen saturation there, and you can make so many deductions. What about hypertrophy? If someone wants to optimize for hypertrophy, how should they train?
Yeah. So we actually have a webinar on that. Evan Picon, he was with Training Think Tank at the time, put together a whole webinar on that. It's on our YouTube channel. I'll send you the link after this. But yeah, he goes through the how would you use this for hypertrophy training. And yeah, you want to pick loads that cause the types of stress that induce hypertrophy. And so then you're going to pick heavier loads. You're going to desaturate all the way, and then you're going to stay at the bottom for some period of time. You're going to say, okay, because if you're not doing that kind of a stress, then that's not enough stress to induce the hypertrophy. Another factor we look at, the sensor actually measures two parameters. It measures the oxygen saturation, that's mostly what we talk about, but it also measures the total hemoglobin. And the total hemoglobin is a measure of, it's kind of an indicator of blood volume. So it's what's going on with blood volume in the muscle. And that can be really important for selecting the load in weight training or any kind of strength training. So at low loads, like maybe 0 to 50% of maximum voluntary contraction, and this varies a lot from person to person, so this isn't a hard, fast number, but something like 0 to 50%, you get a compression reaction. So as soon as you apply the load, we see the total hemoglobin go down. And that's because the muscle tension is squeezing blood out of the muscle. That's a super common reaction. And then when you release the load, we'll see that THB creep back up. It'll go back to where it was because it's this mechanical, you know, you're just squeezing and then releasing. From 50 to 70%, and again, this is highly variable, we get what we would call a venous occlusion. And that's where you're really restricting the blood outflow. So because the venous pressure is lower than your arterial pressure, you know, you're not letting blood get out of the muscle. And we see the muscle pump up with blood. And we see that as just a steady, steady increase in THB. So you're lifting, and THB just keeps creeping up and up and up for the duration. And then you stop lifting and the THB drops back down. And that's because you released the tension and now you let the blood out. And the classical example of this is rock climbers get forearm pump. And that's because their muscles are actually, they literally increase in size because they get more blood, you know, pooling in the muscles because they're not able to relax enough to let the tension down. But we see that as this increasing THB, we call that a venous occlusion. And then once you get over 70% of MVC, or, you know, like I say, it varies a lot, but from person to person, but then we get an arterial occlusion where you completely stop the blood flow. Now, not everyone is strong enough to get an arterial occlusion, but most people can do it if you do like a super hard isometric contraction, and then you see the THB just go straight flat because there's no blood coming in, there's no blood going out, and you're not going to last long. Your SMO2 is going way, way down. And, you know, this is when you're getting really close to, the maximum voluntary contraction force. But you can use that to help guide, again, the type of stress you want. Do you want to do arterial occlusions? You get that SMO2 dropping super rapidly. That is also an indication that you're stressing that muscle enough. If you're not getting an arterial occlusion, you can't get there, then maybe you need to adjust the load or adjust your technique or something else, but you're not going to get that maximal kind of stress, both from a, it's an indication of the tension in the muscle. So you're not getting the tension that would help induce the hypertrophy, and you're not getting that metabolic stress either. And so that you definitely would use that THB for feedback when you're designing your loading, to give you the feedback on what kind of stress you're really causing in that muscle.
So it sounds like the time under tension matters a lot here. If we think about it in terms of rep ranges and time under tension, how can we, like, assuming I'm wearing the sensor right now and I'm going to do 8 reps and 4 seconds of the negative of the movement, how can I, what is it going to be reflected in the oxygen saturation levels?
Yeah, so you'd see that, you could see this on your phone or on a watch. You'd be seeing the data live while you're working out. And you can set an alarm so that it'll tell you when you get below a certain number. So you can get an audible feedback, because it's not always easy to watch the data while you're lifting, you'll see that as soon as you start lifting, it's going to start going down. And then how fast it goes down is related to, are you letting any blood get into the muscle? If you're only at a compression reaction, it's not going to go down nearly as fast as if you have an arterial occlusion reaction. It'll go down, much faster. It's also related just to how much energy you're having to produce, because it's that balance between supply and demand. And if you stop supply and increase demand a lot, it goes down, way faster. And so you'll see that in real time. And then you'll see as soon as you stop, it maybe takes 2 or 3 seconds, and then it starts going back up. So it's very rapid. And then you'll see this rapid increase. And it's fascinating too, how fast you recover is also related on how well you can relax. And so there is an interesting study was done on rock climbers. They were measuring on their forearms, and they have the rock climbers hanging on this ledge by their fingertips. And it's like impossible, but they could do it. And the ones that were really good at that, the ones that could hang on for a long time, you would see that the SMO2 would actually be going up and down as it went down. And that's because they were able to offload the load to different muscles in their fingers to give them a moment of relaxation to let more blood in. And you can see that, you can just see it in the data. It's super clear. There's this oscillating pattern in the SMO2 as they're doing it. And that's super important in recovery, is that ability to relax so that you can get, blood into the muscle. And that occurs like even in cyclists on the pedal stroke, can you get blood into that muscle on the return stroke of the pedals when that muscle has a moment to relax? And the same would happen in the weightlifting, if you can relax more, you'll recover faster. And so that's an aspect of the, knowing when you can start your next set. And then there's kind of like even bigger picture, you can use it. It's interesting what happens as your body fatigues. So your brain protects yourself. Your brain prevents you from hurting yourself too bad. And you can override it if you're really, have a lot of willpower or whatever. But to a large extent, your brain will protect yourself from injuring yourself. And one of the ways it does that is it recruits less muscle fibers as you get fatigued. So in lifting, that's one of the reasons why you can't lift as much as you get fatigued. But it also, you can also compensate by using other muscles. So, your form changes, and your form can get bad and things like that when you when you're getting fatigue. But then we see that in the SMO2 reading, we'll see that you can't get as low as you once did because you don't have as much muscle. That muscle that we're measuring on isn't doing as much work and isn't producing as much tension because of the lesser recruitment in muscle fibers. And we'll see that, you know, where you used to be able to get, you know, the first three sets, you could get down to 20%. Now, all of a sudden, you can only get down to 25%. And the next one, you can only get down to 27%. And so there's this long-term fatigue aspect that we can see in the data as well. And that can, you may want to say, well, I'm done with this exercise now because at that point I'm doing something different. You know, my form has changed, and even though I'm still lifting the load, I should probably stop, or, you know, that's, I may get injured or something like that. Or I may be training a movement that I don't really want to train. You get that feedback on things aren't going the same as what they were a little bit ago, and you may want to adjust.
Mm. We spoke about weightlifting. We spoke about cycling. What other use cases have you seen with the sensor, and what do you expect in the future to see here as well?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think the endurance sports is kind of the easiest to get your head around applications, and the endurance people are really used to, you know, measuring their physiology. They measure heart rate and power and cadence, and they do blood lactate and all of that. And so, I think that's kind of why that area has taken off first. And then the strength training, I think there's a lot of need. You know, like you mentioned earlier, there's not a huge number of sensors available. I mean, bar velocity has come out recently, and that's really good, but it still doesn't tell you anything physiological about the person. Yeah. Really. It's measuring that output, which is great to pair with the physiologic data. And so I think that's those two areas are super interesting. I think we're going to see a lot more development in like physical therapy areas. So when you have someone that's injured, we can see, you know, have they recovered from their injury? We do a lot of symmetry work when we're working in physical therapy. We say, you know, is the left side acting the same as the right side? And when you have an injury, your body does all kinds of compensations to avoid the pain and avoid, you know, tweaking the injury worse. And a lot of that is subconscious. And so like on a cyclist, you put a sensor on each leg and have a left, right power meter. And then you can say, are the legs producing the same power and are they having the same physiologic response? Same thing, you know, in a more strength and conditioning application, you might do squat jumps on a dual force plate and say, are both legs producing the same amount of force and are both legs having the same physiologic response? And then also when you're designing movements to stress, like maybe you want to stress a certain tendon. Well, we don't measure on the tendon, but we can measure on the muscle that's connected to it. And we can say, we want to put enough stress on that muscle so that we're getting it up to a venous occlusion at least. Then we'll know that they're actually doing the movement correctly. And so you can see that, you can get that feedback. And the physical therapists are super good at, identifying what's wrong and developing movements. But then we get that feedback that the athlete or the subject is actually doing the movement correctly. We can say, yep, you know, this is stressing the muscle that we want to stress because we know its saturation went down. And so then we know we're stressing that tendon that's connected to it. And that's what we wanted to do. You know, a lot of the stuff they want to do is put a controlled, they don't want to break the tendon because it's injured or whatever, but they want to put a controlled stress on that. And this would give them that feedback. And that's what we're seeing develop. I think there's a lot more opportunity in that space as well, you know, just to see that. And then I think injury prediction or injury prevention, identifying injuries before they happen or when it's a minor injury and we don't want it to become a major injury, getting more sensitive to that.
How would that work?
So the one way people are doing that is with the dual force plates. They're looking at seeing if they start to see asymmetries in the MOXIE numbers, then they suspect that something's wrong. There's something is sore, and the reason you want to catch it then is because when there is something that's sore, the body's adapting by changing its running form or something like that to avoid that soreness. That's when you're going to be more prone to the injury. And then we also see people doing this like with beep tests, and they'll see you know, have them do a beep test until they fatigue, and they kind of produce a signature. There's a certain way that they fatigue, and then look at that week after week after week and say, oh, all of a sudden it's different. Well, what changed? Why all of a sudden did that change on that person? So those types of things are being done as well. And I think that, you know, that's more of like a team sport, you know, like your football or your basketball, those kinds of sports where you want to identify, has something changed in how they run or how they do their movement? And then, you know, should we be concerned about figuring out what's changed in that person?
One of the things we didn't discuss is about some athletes that are using it for that. I think last conversation we had, we spoke about very famous athletes that already use the sensor today. Can you give us maybe an idea of some of the people that are using it and how they are applying it today?
Yeah, so I think the most famous would be Christian Blumenfeld and Gustav Iden. They're they've got some world championships and Olympic medals between them, quite a number of them, and they've been using this for quite a long time. So I think since 2014 or 15, they started using it. And their trainer Olav Alexander Bu has done, you know, quite a lot of development work in this space. So he's a great guy to work with. The way it's interesting how they started, and I actually recommend that a lot of people start the same way, is they just put the sensor on and didn't change anything. They just wanted to see the data. And Olav instructed them, don't do anything different, you know, just the data will be on your head, because they can see it on the head unit on their Garmin. And he said, don't do anything different. Just here's the data. But then at the time, they were working on doing more precise intensity control through lactate. So they were using lactate to control intensity. And they were struggling to keep their intensity. I forget how it worked exactly. One of them kept wanting to go harder, and the other one kept wanting to back off on the intensity. So they were struggling to keep their intensity at the level they wanted. And Olav tells the story. He said, well, he noticed all of a sudden that they were spot on. Everything was, they were hitting their intensities exactly like they wanted. Well, they had learned what SMO2 value was good for them. And so then they just by looking at their head unit, you know, they didn't do any mathematical analysis or anything, but they just, they learned when they were doing the intensity that their trainer wanted, that's where their SMO2 was. And if they kept it there, then they were getting the correct intensity. And so they've really used it for that precise intensity feedback. So when they go to altitude, they keep their SMO2 at that level, depending on the stress they want of that day. If they want a high stress day, they'll run it lower. If they want, you know, more of a recovery day, then they'll stay away from that that level. So that they've really used it for that precise intensity feedback. And then they've used it for things like they've tested out shoes, you know, how does the shoes change their oxygenation? They've done things like with bike fitting and other things, but the reason they're wearing it, you know, every day for training is really for that precise intensity control.
You mentioned shoes. How does this correlate?
I haven't seen the results from that. I know they did some testing with it, but there's some shoes claim to have higher running efficiency than others. And if that's true, you should see that show up in the oxygenation data. Now that would have to be, these are really small changes in the running efficiency. And so you'd see really small changes in the oxygenation. But if you did a really controlled test, you should be able to find that. And I don't, like I said, I don't know the results of that, but those are the kinds of things that you can get this objective feedback on. You know, if someone says, here, these shoes will have you, you know, give you a better running efficiency. Well, that's hard to verify. You think, well, they're brighter colors, so they make me run faster or something. But this way you get a much more objective measure of that type of thing. That bike fitting is another one where, you know, does changing a bike fit, you may get yourself a little bit more aero, but have a big physiologic cost to doing that. And so you may choose to adjust the bike fit if it doesn't give you, if it costs too much physiologically.
Mm-hmm. What other data can you combine here? So there are a lot of wearables out there with a lot of information. What other data points would you combine to understand better what's going on for an athlete?
That's a really good question, because the the MOXIe data is useful by itself, but then it's really useful when it's combined with other data. And, you know, and that's where I'm super excited about the things you guys are doing there with Terra, because it makes this more possible. It makes it more feasible. It's always possible to combine the data, but doing this on a large scale with large numbers of athletes where you're getting data from multiple sources is a challenge. And I'm super excited for what you guys are doing in this space. So like right now we see a lot of people use their MOXIe with VO2 data. So we have, you know, we have integrations like with the VO2 master, with Core Medical, Cortex, Cosmed, a handful of other VO2 devices where you can get your VO2 data and your MOXIe data all in one app, saved in one file. And that works really well. We just had a recent integration with Delsys for EMG measurements. Now that's mainly used in research. It's used sometimes in training, but used a lot in research. And that's another case where getting the EMG data along with the muscle oxygen data is super useful. We don't have an integration with Bar Velocity yet, but I'd love, you know, if there's a company out there that has Bar Velocity, we'd love to work with you on doing some kind of integration with Bar Velocity, because I think seeing what happens when your bar velocity slows down, as you fatigue, what is your muscle oxygen doing? That could be really informative. And seeing, do they correlate? You know, do you see a physiologic response at the same time that you slow down? Or is it more of a motivational issue? You know, I think in strength training, that's always a little bit of a question. And so that you know, integration with Bar Velocity would be really tremendous. I think that would be a great application. And then another one is GPS data. Like they'll have these devices they wear on their back. We already have an integration with Wimu. They're a Spanish company that makes a GPS device, but then there's other GPS devices out there where it'd be really nice to get their acceleration data and, you know, their time at speed kind of data, their time versus how fast they're running. And in sports like soccer, basketball, you know, even American football, it'd be really great to have that information where you could see they just did a long, long run. Their SMO2 is really low. And now we're starting to see all these elements of fatigue setting in. And then how long does it take them to recover from that? So, you know, getting that data combined, I think would really tell a pretty amazing story, you know, in those kinds of sports.
For my last question, what should we expect for the next 5 years from MOXIe?
And yeah, that's a really good question.
And maybe another one, just to add them together, it's what do you think is the future of our space?
The future of the space?
Of our space, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So I think these are related. That's maybe the same answer. Is I think what really needs to happen is this data needs to be seamless to the user. You can't have your data in separate places, and it needs to be. It needs to be like some of the integrations we do now are very specific. You know, it works with this app, but not this other app. And so I think as much as we can do to make that data so that it's just where you want it without you even having to think about it. And we're working on those things. You know, we follow some standards with how our data is saved, and we're, you know, continue to do that. We have our own app called MOXIe Portal. We have plans to make it a lot easier to get that data out of that system in an automatic fashion so that you can set it up so that when you're done, your data just shows up. It already does that. Like when we work with a Garmin, your data shows up in Training Peaks. You don't have to push a single button. Your data is just there. And that, I think, is kind of the ideal, that your data should just be wherever you want it to be when you expect it to be there. And that is where our development is going. And then the other area where, you know, this is more MOXIe specific, but the science is so young here. It's really just getting started. I mean, this is like, we're just starting to scratch the surface of what can be done in this space. And we see it in research. You know, there's a lot of research going on. About half of our sensors actually go into research applications. I think we're going to see more of that research, but we're going to see that research get translated into practical applications for training more effectively. And, you know, the Norwegians are really at the forefront of this. The Norwegian triathletes, they collect a ton of data. They're super meticulous, and they're really using that data to inform their training. And I think where they're a little bit of an anomaly right now, I think that's going to become the standard. I think it's going to become much more standard that you're going to use all kinds of physiologic data in addition to MOXIE, but MOXIE is certainly going to be an important part of it, to be able to inform the training so that you're getting more benefit for lower cost, more benefit in terms of performance for lower cost in terms of, you know, training energy that you have to put it, time and effort that you have to put in.